facilities or systems. Even with the misdemeanor, the Department of Justice has long required that investigators develop strong evidence to indicate government employees knew they were doing something improper in their handling of the classified information. In Secretary Clinton's case, the answer to the first question, was classified information mishandled, was obviously yes. In all, there were 36 email chains that discussed topics that were classified as secret at the time. 8 times in those thousands of email exchanges across 4 years, Clinton and her team talked about topics designated as top secret, sometimes cryptically, sometimes obviously. They didn't send each other classified documents, but that didn't matter. Even though the people involved in the emails all had appropriate clearances and a need to know, anyone who had ever been granted a security clearance should have known that talking about top secret information on an unclassified system was a breach of rules governing classified materials. Although just a small slice of Clinton's emails, those exchanges on top secret topics were, by all appearances, improper. Put another way, there were 36 email chains about topics that could cause serious damage to national security, and 8 that could be expected to cause exceptionally grave damage to the security of the United States if released. The heart of the case, then, was the second question. What was she thinking when she did this? Was it sloppy, or was there criminal intent? Could he prove that she knew she was doing something she shouldn't be doing? Knowing and proving what is in someone's head is always a hard task. At the front of my mind from the start of this investigation was the recent case of former CIA Director David Petraeus, which had concluded only a few months earlier. In 2011, Petraeus had given multiple notebooks containing troves of highly sensitive, top-secret information to an author with whom he was having an affair. In contrast to those Hillary Clinton corresponded with, the author did not have the appropriate clearance or a legitimate need to know the information, which included notes of discussions with President Obama about very sensitive programs. Petraeus was the CIA director, for heaven's sake, in charge of the nation's secrets. He knew as well as anyone in government that what he did was wrong. He even allowed the woman to photograph key pages from classified documents. And then, as if to underscore that he knew that he shouldn't do what he did, he lied to FBI agents about what he had done. Despite all of this clear and powerful evidence, on facts far worse for him than for Secretary Clinton, and after he demonstrably lied to the FBI, the Department of Justice charged him only with a misdemeanor after he reached a plea bargain agreement. In April 2015, he admitted guilt and agreed to a $40,000 fine and probation for 2 years. The misdemeanor charge Petraeus received for mishandling classified material was reasonable and consistent with past cases. But I argued strongly to Attorney General Holder that Petraeus also should be charged with a felony for lying to the Bureau. Replaying in my mind the Martha Stewart, Leonidas Young, and Scooter Libby cases, I argued that if we weren't going to hold retired generals and CIA directors accountable for blatantly lying during investigations, how could we justify jailing thousands of others for doing the same thing? I believed, and still believe, that Petraeus was treated under a double standard based on class. A poor person? An unknown person? Say a young black Baptist minister from Richmond? Would be charged with a felony and sent to jail. Despite the endless drumbeat in the conservative media, filled with exaggerated scandals and breathless revelations of little practical import, Hillary Clinton's case, at least as far as we knew at the start, did not appear to come anywhere near General Petraeus's in the volume and classification level of the material mishandled. Although she seemed to be using an unclassified system for some classified topics, everyone she emailed appeared to have both the appropriate clearance and a legitimate need to know the information. So although we were not going to prejudge the result, we started the Clinton investigation aware that it was unlikely to be a case that the career prosecutors at the Department of Justice would prosecute. That might change, of course, if we could find a smoking gun email where someone in government told Secretary Clinton not to do what she was doing, or if we could prove she obstructed justice, or if she, like Petraeus, lied to us during an interview. It would all turn on what we could prove beyond a reasonable doubt, a very different standard from that of television talk shows or congressional soundbites. Washington being a tribal city, prominent Republicans immediately and predictably began chanting that the Obama administration couldn't be trusted to investigate the Democratic Party's presidential frontrunner and a former official in the Obama administration. Many Republicans, prodded by self-appointed legal and investigative experts on their favored media outlets, and often reacting to inaccurate or misleading news reports, seem certain the former Secretary of State had committed the worst crime since the Rosenbergs gave our nuclear secrets to the Russians in the 1950s and were executed for it. The Democrats, in turn, were dismissive of the case from the outset, claiming the examination of the emails wasn't even an investigation, but merely a review or some other tortured euphemism. Under intense pressure from the Clinton presidential campaign, the New York Times walked back a story published on July 23, 2015, reporting that the Justice Department was considering opening a criminal investigation into Clinton's handling of her emails. As a result of the Clinton team's tenacious pushback, the Times appended two separate corrections to its original article, first claiming that Mrs. Clinton herself was not the focus of any investigation, and then, a day later, changing the description of the Inspector General's transmission to the FBI from criminal referral to security referral. Though the Times may have thought those clarifications were necessary, their original story was much closer to the mark. It was true that the transmission to the FBI from the Inspector General did not use the word criminal, but by the time of the news story, we had a full criminal investigation open, focused on the Secretary's conduct. We didn't correct the Times and contradict the Clinton campaign because, consistent with our practice, we were not yet to a point where it was appropriate to confirm an investigation. Still, the bitterly fought episode, parsing word choices, was only a small taste of what was to come, and many within the FBI knew it. You know you're totally screwed, right? The FBI deputy director in the summer of 2015 was a plain-spoken, smart, and darkly funny career special agent named Mark Giuliano. I smiled tightly. Yep, I said, nobody gets out alive. This, of course, was not my first time in the middle of something guaranteed to antagonize, even outrage, some very powerful people. In a way I couldn't have imagined then, Martha Stewart, Scooter Libby, Stellar Wind, and the Bush administration's torture policy were all preparation for what lay ahead. Under great pressure in all those situations, we had tried to push outside voices aside and to follow the law and the facts. Even in hindsight, I still thought we had done the right thing. The Clinton investigation or inquiry or referral or whatever people on either side of the political spectrum chose to call it was already a major topic in the emerging presidential campaign. Giuliano's point, which I saw clearly, was that this was a no-win situation for the FBI. At the core of Mark's gallows humor was a gallows. No matter what the honest outcome, the institution's credibility and mine would be damaged.